Hello and welcome to iPod, the College of Optometrists podcast, where we explore the profession and the fascinating world of vision and eye care, discover new ideas and research, and learn from each other's experiences. Today it's being hosted by me, Ruth Bennett, Deputy Lead Assessor on the Scheme for Registration. Our topic is anxiety. I'm joined by Dave Burke, Mental Health First Aid Instructor. Hello, Dave.
Hiya.
And Neil Constantine Smith, who has been an optometrist for more than 30 years. Hello, Neil.
Hello.
We've been given some really interesting questions from our members to discuss, which we will come to. But let me start with you, Neil, and open up. Neil, when have you been aware of anxiety as an optometrist?
Well, I suppose I've seen anxiety through all my career, but it's really becoming more prevalent recently. Anybody, really. Patients, I have anxious patients. I have quite a few patients who will only come and see me because they're anxiety about coming into the medical setting. I'm also an assessor and examiner, so from that point of view, I see a lot of anxious trainees, and I think the anxiety in that particular sphere is becoming a little bit more prevalent as well. But I have my own anxiety. When I'm at work, when I've got a full clinic and I've got deadlines and I've got GP letters, that gives my own anxiety that I have to manage during the day.
Thank you. And Dave, what sparked your interest in mental health?
Well, I spent a lifetime really trying to support people in one way or another, often emotionally, and quite often when they've been facing challenges to what we now call mental health. But 40 years ago when I got started, we didn't really have a term for it, but people were frightened, their mood was low and they couldn't explain why, and sometimes they were behaving bizarrely. My involvement started a long time ago and work now with all kinds of organisations in helping people to learn how to support other people.
That's really interesting. So can you tell us, what is anxiety? Because you mentioned that it wasn't a term that was used 40 years ago or understood in the way that it is now. So what is anxiety?
40 years ago, people might have said they're worried or they're worried sick, or where I come from in the northeast of England, people would have said, I'm feeling really chewed, which sums up the feeling in your guts when you're feeling very anxious. Anxiety is when we get overwhelmed with worry about something. And it's a completely normal and natural human response to either something which is fearful, maybe an exam or an assessment, or we've got things coming up that we don't like the look of, or to actual danger. And that can come in a variety of disguises. So it's a natural response to the need to either protect ourselves or run away or perform.
That's interesting, thank you. And why does anxiety happen then?
It happens basically because we have a physiological system called the fight or flight response. So animal behaviourists call it fight, fright, flight, submit or freeze, because different animals respond in those four different ways. Under circumstances when we feel threatened or we have a need to perform. And it's human physiology. Hypothalamus tells endocrine organs to release certain substances, adrenaline, cortisol, two of them, there are others, and that has a number of physiological effects on our body. It also has psychological effect. We feel awful and we want to run away, and that's all deliberate. It's all part of the design. And I would say really, you and I and Neil, we're here today because we had quite anxious ancestors. They were able to recognize danger, respond to it well. They survived, reproduced, and here we are. So it's a big success story. The anxiety system is part of us. It's who we are.
What you've described sounds a lot like being nervous. So what's the difference then between being nervous, you know, anticipating something and feeling nervous, and anxiety?
Well, all of us feel anxious from time to time in our lives, and it's going to depend on the circumstances. So we might feel under danger or threat, so we feel anxious. We might feel the need to perform, like an exam or an assessment, so we feel anxious. So far, so normal. There are times when those feelings get the better of us. And we can usually tell that's happening because we start avoiding things because they might make us frightened. Or we start imagining things that are bigger than the actual threat. We start, well, the word is catastrophizing. Mm. We make it bigger than it actually is. And at that point, anxiety can get the better of us. And again, all of us go through times in our lives when we are subject to that. Even battleship commanders and fast jet pilots, combat pilots, experience those things. So when we feel anxious or even very anxious, it's not an illness. That's us. That's responding to the circumstances that we're in. But that can get completely out of hand to the point where the anxiety becomes a disorder in medical terminology, an illness that needs some specialist treatment, professional treatment. So to some degree, anxiety is normal. But there's a sort of spectrum into which, further on into which, it starts to become dysfunctional and we need to get some help for it.
And what you're describing is that, is it a spectrum then of ranging from normals, or is there a point at which someone could think, this isn't normal, this is something that I need help with? And I wonder how people might recognise the difference.
Yeah, I mean, describe myself. I'm a fairly sort of non-anxious kind of person, but there are some things that make me feel anxious. Being in confined spaces makes me feel anxious. Now, I'll feel a frisson of anxiety if I'm in the London Underground, or if I'm, locked in a room having an eye test in the dark. However, I'll feel more anxiety if I'm under pressure at that time. So I moved house recently, and it was chaos because the day had to move, and we had to change our arrangements, and the van didn't turn up on time. I noticed in the weeks that followed, I was way more sensitive to the things that make me anxious because I wasn't in a great place emotionally, generally, at that time, and then gradually came out of that. Now, all of that is normal. That's what happens. I know when it's abnormal. I'm going to give you four tests. This is the four things that we know that something needs to change. We need to get some professional help. One is time. Is it lasting a long time? Is it going on and it's not calming down? The second is intensity. Is it unbearable? Is it overwhelming? And that leads to the third thing, which is disruption. Is it making me change my behavior? Is it making me do things differently, avoid things, make excuses, hide away, withdraw from people? And the final thing is it in control? Is it really in control of me? And I would say if you've got two or three of those, it would be a good moment to have a conversation with a professional so that you can pin down whether you do need some medical or therapeutic help.
So I wonder what things people can do. You've mentioned about speaking to a professional. Are there any things that people can do maybe before that? And what professionals can they speak to? But let's think about how do we manage. You talked about your experiences of anxiety recently. What are the things that we can do in our normal day-to-day lives, and who are the professionals that we can speak to?
I think everyone benefits from a bit of nous around anxiety because it's part of all of our lives. And I think the first thing, really, some very, very basic things, I think, particularly with younger people, students, young professionals. One is get organized, get a diary, get a planner, work out what's happening in the week, make a list. These aren't extra things to do. This is just getting your brain organized for the week ahead or the day ahead. And that's a tremendous anxiety calmer when you actually look and see what's on the list, what you've got to do. I have priorities and posteriorities. The posteriorities are very important. They're the things you put at the bottom of the list and you think, well, I can lose that. I don't have to do that today. And that takes the pressure off you a little bit. The second thing is make some time for yourself. Now, against a background where young professionals particularly are working their socks off to get qualifications, get a job, etc., this is really important. And the way I like to put it is to say, give yourself something to look forward to at the end of the day, at the end of the week, and at the end of the job. So at the end of the day, I need something to look forward to. So I give myself an hour just to do something I love, something that's fun. At the end of the week, take a day off. It takes a lot of nerve if you're revising for exams or for an assessment, but it really is worth it because it enables your psyche and your body to absorb everything you've been doing the rest of the week. I took a whole day off a week during my final exams. Everybody thought I was bonkers. I went rock climbing the night before my first exam. And it could I have done better in the exam? Maybe. But I did okay. So that's the second thing. Give yourself something to look forward to at the end of the job. So when you've done the assessment, when you've done the exam, plan the party for what happens afterwards. It might be a holiday, might be an actual party. But give yourself something to look forward to at the end of that season. And you'll find that those things kind of pull you through. And you know that this isn't going on forever. And you can give yourself permission to stop. Third thing, avoid perfectionism. Perfectionism is a killer. Think about being good enough. Not the best. Not top of the class. Good enough. That is a tremendous adjuster. One of the most anxious times in my life was when my first child was born, Johnny. And my guts were in a knot. My head was all over the place. I couldn't think straight. And this lasted for about 6 months. I was very, very anxious. And I was walking through WH Smith's in Leicester one day. And I just caught the title of a book in the self-help section. And the book was called The Good Enough Parent. I never read the book. The title liberated me. I thought, yeah, I can do that. I can't be the best dad, but I can be a good enough dad. And it just kind of liberated me. So think of good enough and not perfection. And the fourth thing is breathe. Breathing is amazingly good for you.
Oh, we all breathe.
We do. And you probably know yourself that at times of stress, anxiety, in every walk, just pausing and taking a few breaths and not letting yourself getting into that short of breath, heart racing type, calming down for a few moments, resets your physiology, resets your head.
Yeah, there's two bits on there that I really agree with and sort of I've used myself in practice. I talked to myself earlier about me being anxious sometimes in practice. The list taking and the list making certainly helped me. I used to be a practice manager or an Opton manager. I'd test 4 days a week and I have a management day. And I would find that during my testing days, I wouldn't have any time to do anything other than test eyes. So any job that came about I had to do as a manager, it was there in my brain. So I had to put that down on a list. And then when it came to my management day, I would prioritize all those to-do things and I'd get them done. But if I didn't write them down, they'd be there rattling around in my brain. And that would really add to my anxiety as I went along, because undoubtedly you'd forget something because you'd be busy and think, oh no, I should have done that. So that really helped me as well. The other thing is that taking time out, recognizing that if I am stressing in a clinic, I've got a couple of letters to do, somebody comes along with a retinal detachment, then breathe. I go into an empty test room, a minute of just calming myself down, pressing my off button, and then I go back into the fray and I'm in a much better position myself to carry on. So a couple of things you said I'm using already, but I do like the things that you said about, you know, giving myself a treat, which for me will be chocolate mostly.
Oh, me too.
Excellent. Yes.
And I recognise what you're saying about perfectionism. I think when I was in school, perfectionism was really seen as a positive thing, and you know, work had to be very neat and tidy. And I could never really subscribe to this, and wasn't kind of like the neat and tidy fellow pupils that I seemed to be surrounded by in a grammar school that I was in. But as an adult, I've come to recognize that not being a perfectionist is incredibly liberating, because perfectionism can really hold us down. And actually, it needs to be good enough. And it's never going to be perfect. And that has been quite a liberating thing to realise. The perfectionism that I felt I wanted at school and never was, has been a real help as an adult.
There's a lot of research happening at the moment about perfectionism. And a lot of it's focusing on social media driven perfectionism, the pressure to be fabulous. But I think it goes further back than that, in the sense that when you start school, you enter what is basically a toothpaste tube, and you are required to perform at every stage. And the pressure of living with that for 10 years plus builds itself into our systems, and we do become quite driven when it comes to that. One of the most memorable things for me was a teenage girl, friend of the family, who fell apart in our living room because she'd come second in a test at school. She was a mess and a brilliant student at the same time. And getting her to accept being second, well, that was really the story of her life psychologically for a while.
And I think that's getting worse in education. With SATs year seven, I know my two sons were, the stress they had put on them at their primary school to do well in their SATs, you know, when they would come home, we'd say, it doesn't matter to us, just because it matters to the school. But they were had that pressure from that age. So that's year seven, that's your 10-year-old. So it's starting from then, really.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about anxiety can become an illness, can take over, and it can be something that is ill. And I suppose, how do we recognise that? When does it become an illness?
Well, the four kind of little tests, I suppose you could call them, are worth just repeating. That time, if it goes on for a long time, I think generalized anxiety disorder, one of the diagnostic criteria would be that you feel anxious like this more often than not over a period of 6 months, something like that. At that point, it's really disruptive. And if it goes on, see a professional. Think about how you can do that in a minute. Intensity as well. If it's overwhelming, if it's unbearable, and it masks everything else, then you really need to see somebody, talk to somebody about it. And the other two things, it's changing your behavior, it's disrupting your life. You find yourself avoiding things, not doing the things that you love doing because you're anxious about something, not doing the things you need to do. And the fourth one would be, it's got control of you. It's controlling you. If any of those things are happening, it would be good to talk to a professional. And there's a couple of ways you can do that. One is to see a GP and have a conversation with that person. These days, most GPs are very alert to these things. They won't pump you full of drugs straight away. There are a number of therapeutic pathways that do not involve medication, although it might involve medication. Because for some people, what's going wrong fundamentally is chemical. But the other thing would be, you might not want to talk to your GP, and so a number of other possibilities. One would be improving access to psychological therapies, IAPT. So if you Google IAPT in your town, it will give you a result, a phone number you can phone, and you can self-refer for NHS provided psychological help, counselling or cognitive behavioural therapy. That's really, really useful. If your company has this, an EAP, an employee assistance programme, will be able to give you access to counselling very quickly. If you have the means, just Google counselling directory and find a counsellor you like the look of. It's about £50 a pop, but it might be worth it just to give you some backup from a professional person.
Thank you. And I know we have resources on the website, on the wellbeing page of the College of Optometrists website, where people can look at those and a few other links as well. But even when anxiety isn't an illness, it can be pretty unpleasant. And how can we manage those feelings?
I think the things we've talked about, you know, breathe and give yourself something to look forward to, those are important. But they're actually, to some degree, kind of management techniques. I actually think it really helps with anxiety if you change the way you look at it. And this takes us into the realm of your philosophy of life, if you like. Embracing anxiety as part of you. It's not an illness from outside, it's you. When it becomes an illness, it is a threat and a problem, and you need treatment. But for most of the time, even when we're a bit overwhelmed with anxiety, it's me responding to the circumstances. Some of us might need to square up with the fact that we're slightly anxious as people. We're not cut out to be jet pilots or battleship commanders. We're cut out to be optometrists who are really sensitive to people who are anxious when they turn up in our consulting room. That means you've got a superpower. So tap into it as part of you, and it can make you more effective with your job. I've got a friend who teaches dance, and her students often phone up before an exam saying, I can't do it. And she says, when she's sure it's not real illness, she says, now you come along and do it and put your feelings into your performance. So I would say that. I'd say put your feelings into your performance as optometrists or whatever walk of life you're in, because it can sensitize you to other people and their needs. The other thing, I think, going a bit deeper is how we see life as a whole. There's a German theologian called Reinhold Niebuhr, and he knew a lot about anxiety. It really upset Hitler. This is in the 1930s. And he wrote a prayer that's become quite famous. It's called the Serenity Prayer. Give me the serenity to know the things that I can change and the things that can't be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's quite an important philosophy. And in fact, it's the first reading for January the 1st in a completely non-religious book called The Daily Stoic, because it's a really good example of a philosophical way to live your life. What can I change? What can I not change? And working with the things I can't change, accepting the things I can't change. There's great freedom in acceptance. And whatever your philosophy of life is or religion is, there's something of that in there. Tap into that. Because I think we need something deeper than just breathing when we're trying to live with difficult times in our lives.
Wow. I'm going to write that down.
We were going to talk about optometry, Neil, and how we manage this ourselves if there's a really busy clinic. So I'm trying to think, how do we apply what we've just learned? How can we manage anxiety if things are busy and we're in a busy clinic? How do you manage that, or how does that work for you?
I can tell you what I do personally too, because as I said earlier, the thing that stresses me out more is running late, having difficult patients, and thinking I've got to get back on time again, and also remember the stuff I've got may have to do from earlier on, making sure that the field test that I've requested gets done and things like that. Writing things down is a big thing for me, to be able to make sure I don't forget it, because that's the last thing you want, is at the end of the go, oh no, I didn't do that, or I didn't check that field, or this patient's gone without having a dilation appointment, that type of thing. So writing things down is a big thing for me. I tend to not look at the clock, because that stresses me out. And I've got people that run my clinic. So I say at the front, quite often when I work somewhere new, they'll say, oh, this patient's turned up 10 minutes late. And I say, I don't want to make that decision. You decide. You give me a board. I'm going to. So I suppose it does go back to what you said, Dave. What can I do? Then I can test this patient and I can make sure this patient has the best eye examination they have. I think we were talking earlier on about this might be your 11 o'clock, but this is the one time this patient's going to see you every 2 years. So I want to make that experience from them the best. So that's what I'm going to focus on. Okay, doing my best job for this patient. There are things I can do to, if I have a poor view of the fundus, I'll get them, dilate them on a different day, and that eases me up that way. So I might change my decision making a little bit of how I manage them, but ultimately I'm just going to concentrate on them, let the clock and let my colleagues outside look after my clinic for me. That's my biggest way of avoiding my biggest stress, which is running behind and people being angry with me. Plus, I'll apologise and say, I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but then I'll give them my 100% of my attention and not be thinking, I've got to get this person through quickly. Okay, no, I've got to give them the best eye test. So it was worth waiting for. And so far, it's worked.
One of the GPs in the surgery that I'm registered in always runs late. And you know what? I always try and book in with her because I know once I get into that room, she's going to treat me the way I want to be treated. She's going to take her time and take the time to listen to me. And so I wait, and you do invariably wait a very long time in her clinic. But for me, that's worth it because she's treating me as a human and as a person, and that's precisely why she's running late. So I'm happy to live with that as a patient. And that's something that's valuable to me. So there's a lot about how we approach the idea of a clinic and how it's running, isn't it? And I think somehow connecting human to human with the next person, with that person that's coming into the room and giving them the time that they need can help us.
Yeah, and I think what I've learned about myself is to be able to recognise when I am getting a bit stressed, sweaty hands, I might be breathing a little bit more, I can feel my heart pounding, maybe that, those sort of symptoms. So I've got a question for you, Dave. So can people sort of realise when they need treatment, or can they do things like, because where I live by the seaside, people do a lot of early morning swimming in the ice cold sea, which sounds the worst thing in the world for me to do, but for them it boosts their mood. There's things like obviously breathing, meditation, all these sort of things. Can you self-treat, or is there a point where you go, I'm not doing this myself, I need to go and get professional help?
Yeah, there's a lot of self-help available, and two good places to go would be the National Mind website, which has got fantastic directory of mental health issues and some good self-help advice. Another great place to go is actionforhappiness.org, which does exactly what it says on the tin. Loads and loads of good stuff about things that boost your well-being. I tend to think of this in kind of four directions. The one would be connection with people. Having connection with people is tremendously good for your well-being. Research shows this again and again. So what will nurture your connection with people? Good friends, people you can talk to, or just chit-chatty friends, gossipy friends. All of that is good. The second is connection with the natural world, which again, research says is incredibly valuable. Your
forest bathing, that's another big thing right now. Yeah.
Your forest bathers or your sea swimmers in the middle of January, that's what they're doing. Their bodies, their minds are connecting with the natural world, walking in the forest, walking around the park, just looking after your dog, tending your houseplants. All of those things have a proven flow into your well-being. And the third thing would be connecting with yourself, which, being British, so I'm a British grammar school boy, I hesitate to say that because you're not supposed to connect with yourself. But being aware of, when am I losing my temper and why? Why I'm getting anxious. Why am I getting anxious? I'm starting to feel hungry. I'm starting to feel moody. I'm starting to feel sad. Why? Just being aware of yourself, to do that it's helpful to talk to somebody else, to talk it through with somebody, a friend or a professional, which brings us back to nurturing relationships with people. So being in touch with yourself, meditation is a part of that. Or I pray a lot. And those are tremendously helpful things, whether it's secular or religious, tremendously helpful for people. And that brings me to my fourth thing, which is spirituality. You might not believe in anything in particular, but you believe in right and wrong, good and bad. There are things you do which have nothing to do with your survival as a person, but which are to do with enjoying the richness of life. Just before I came here, I had half an hour in the National Portrait Gallery. It's my go-to place. I've got a bit of time to kill in London. Just looking at a couple of pictures and then coming out, just tapping into something, whatever you define it to be.
Another question then, Dave. Sorry, Ruth, I'm just taking over your podcast here. So I've had two children myself who have now just university and beyond, but I see now the difference in children nowadays that they have a constant need to have something for their attention. So, for example, when I, we used to go for a car trip, I'd have 2.5 hours in the car with nothing to do but look out of the window. If we went for a meal, I'd be talking, or maybe I'd take a pencil and a piece of paper. But there was this makes me sound old, the generation now, is they've got to have a screen. So even when you're walking along, you're on your phone. Even when you're sat down, you're on your phone. There's no time to yourself to think things, think about things, no downtime, because they get bored and it needs to have some sort of screen involved or whatever. Is that a thing, or is that just me being old?
We don't know yet.
Okay.
I genuinely think we don't know yet, because the advent of screens, social media, et cetera, the shift in emphasis for younger people, Generation Z, is we don't know what the result is going to be. Although you and I, being the generation we are, tend to look upon this negatively. But I always think that, back in the 16th century, there would have been people trundling along to Munich in their ox cart saying, I wish that Gutenberg hadn't invented the printing press. These kids have always got their heads stuck in a book. We don't know yet what this is going to lead to. Life's full of surprises.
Well, it's funny you say about walking the dog, actually, because when I'm taking history and symptoms for patients, you say, what do you do as a hobby? And before I got a dog, and they would say, dog walking, and I'd think, well, that's not really a hobby. That's a task you've got to do at home. It's like people saying cleaning is a hobby, but having got a dog, I love walking my dog now. Okay, he listens. He's a really good listener, my dog. Never answers back, never gives me any advice, but he's a really good listener. But I really look forward to that now. So I, because I'm as bad. If I sat down, give me 2 seconds, I'll get my phone out and see what's happening.
Yeah.
But when I'm out for a dog walk, sometimes I forget to take my phone with me, and it's lovely. It's just him and me and the walk. So I think that's a good thing for my mental health. Maybe we should all get dogs. Cats are also available.
I was going to ask about another question we had from one of our members, was how can we protect ourselves at work when you've had a bad day or a really difficult patient? Maybe not all members can get a dog, so maybe we can think of some other suggestions, although that's obviously one of them. But how can we cope if we're coming away from work feeling exhausted or emotionally tired by what's happened?
Well, I think this goes back to what Dave was saying about having something to look forward to. I think that's the thing. It's getting out of, it's being able to forget. I think sometimes you can take the stresses of work with you, can't you? And you just keep on thinking about it. Having somebody to talk to, if you're lucky enough to have a spouse or a partner or a friend you can talk things over with, I think that's really good. Hopefully you should be able to talk with a colleague as well. About your experiences of the day. But I think so, having something to look forward to and something different. I mean, I'm lucky that I love cooking. So my de-stress is to go home, put the radio on loud and do some cooking. And then we have a nice meal and talk about it. So that's how I get out of the stresses of work. I don't know if you would have any more advice about that, Dave?
Yeah, I would back that up. I think change of location is really helpful. If you live on the job, that can be really bad. I've done that a few times. And but so if you don't have a walk home or a ride home, make something that makes the delineation between work and home. And when you're home, do something that you love. And if you don't love cooking, and you can't get anybody else to do it, do other things. Put the radio on, listen to podcasts, stuff like that. It's just, I love disengaging my brain by engaging it with something else.
I did read somewhere that it's 45 minutes, I think, is the optimum time for a commute. 45 minutes, you've got time to dissociate from work and being another place. If it's any more than 45 minutes, then that's just wasted time, but it doesn't add to it. But if it's less than that, you'll end up taking some of that stuff home with you. So if you live 15 minutes from home, walk there and back a couple of times. Make it last 45 minutes.
A dear friend of mine, when he started work in a hospital and his job was reviewing scans of head and neck, he didn't sleep for months because the question, have I missed something? Have I not seen something, was constantly going around in his head. And we met to talk about this over a period of about 6 months. I know nothing about his job. I know nothing about his discipline. All I did was make the tea. But at the end of the 6 months, he said, "That's been really helpful, thank you." And he was sleeping again. And I'm not a counselor. I'm not a specialist. But just having a listening ear, talking it through with somebody who listens, is a tremendous help. So if there is something that's chewing you, that's really preoccupying you, talk it over with someone. It's an astonishing release and helps you organize your own thoughts. They don't have to be an optom.
There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that young professionals are experiencing particularly high levels of anxiety at the moment. So what's going on with that generation? What's going on with those perhaps in their early 20s? And why are they experiencing particularly high levels of anxiety?
I think you're right. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence in the academic world, in your world, where you notice higher levels of anxiety among younger candidates. But it's not just anecdotal. There's quite a lot of research being done. One thing that's worth referring you to is a series of reports done by the Deloitte company. They're business consultants, and they've done, since 2017, an annual report on mental health in the workplace. And I'll just read you a few quotes from the 2020 report, which is available online. You can find it online. So here's just three little pullouts. 18% of the people we talked to disagreed with the statement, life is really worth living. Mm. An increase from 9% of respondents in 2009.
Wow.
That's a huge increase.
Blimey, yeah.
That's
so
huge.
57% thought that social media creates overwhelming pressure to succeed. And 60% said they found it hard not to compare their life with those of others online. And in a 2017 poll of young people by the Women's Trust, when asked what, if anything, made them feel anxious, the most commonly cited reasons chosen from a range of options were the UK leaving the EU, the ability to afford a home in the future, their current financial circumstances, not earning enough to live on, and difficulty finding a job. So I think the objective stuff is starting to reflect a number of specific pressures. One would be social media, the online life, and another would be what people perceive to be tremendous difficulties professionally and socially, getting a home, starting a family, those kinds of things. And I think all of those seem to be very important, the people that I talk to. You can add a few other things to that. I think that derogatorily called it a toothpaste tube, the education system generating very powerful feelings and emotions. Lots and lots of things we have no control over. but seem to be contributing to that. So I think, yeah. As well as that, the fact we're talking about this, we wouldn't have done this 10 years ago. Mm. We wouldn't have done this 20 years ago. And I still meet people who are saying, well, you know, we didn't have this in the war. Why are you talking about it now? Well, you did have this in the war. And I can give you some great examples of aunts and uncles of mine who were a real mess, but couldn't talk about it. And now we're talking about it. And younger people are talking about it more freely than older people. And are more conscious of the need to be attentive to mental health. So I think all of that.
And if you're a young adult, the pandemic will have impacted your education.
Oh, boy.
And that that will, I mean, that's unavoidable, isn't it? That will have had an impact. And we're probably yet to fully understand the extent to which that has had an impact.
Yeah. A lot of research going on about that. There's a unit led from, I think, Sheffield, Prof of Psychology at Sheffield, who's coordinating that, looking at the during and after impact of the pandemic. I think another source of anxiety is the news. I have a little game. Every morning I read two newspapers. I won't name them. And one of them I find particularly funny because everything is a crisis. Almost every headline has the word crisis in it. Most of them are not crises. They're emergencies, they're situations, they're problems, they're things that get up the editor's nose. But it's not a crisis. But the language of crisis and the tendency of media to predict the next crisis as though it was definitely going to happen, that's a huge, huge problem, I think, because it's all around. So one good tip, if you start to feel really anxious, is stop reading the news. Don't watch the news. That's somebody else's problem for the time being, not yours.
A huge thank you to both of you for your comments, insights and experiences. I have found that discussion really interesting and helpful. We hope you listening have also found the podcast useful. There may be other people who you know either professionally or personally who would find this helpful for them as well. So do pass on a link to them. We will add some links to the websites and resources that we've mentioned in our notes section. If you're a supervisor or a trainee on the scheme for registration, then do listen out for our second podcast, during which we will discuss anxiety in the context of clinical work, assessments and exams. It is important that I say that none of the conversation is intended to replace professional advice. So if you're concerned, then do seek professional advice. Thank you for listening.